Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to another edition of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. We are officially, I think it's been a while that we've been officially inside of the clay season, but the first tournaments of importance have just happened in the ATP side. We've had Monte Carlo and Barcelona. Those are already done. Our winners, Ruud and Tsitsipas, in back-to-back finals, which is actually kind of really interesting. And then the WTA, the first red clay tournament that they've played in Stuttgart, which is always a very packed draw, very intense, mostly because there are three WTA 1000s as there are in the ATP side. We had like some really interesting matches on that side as well. A while ago, we had Charleston, where Danielle Collins backed up her Miami win with another title back-to-back. So it's like 3 weeks, two titles straight. So that's really interesting. So she might become a factor. And since that we are on this, actually, first of all, hey, Vansh, how are you doing?
Doing good, yeah. It's always fun to do these podcasts, especially during clay season, you know, leading up to Roland Garros. There's always a lot of, you know, data gathering, and usually a lot of players are like, you know, we're trying to see where they all at heading into Roland Garros, and like, some tournaments give us more information than others, but it's always fun to monitor the progress of all these top players heading into Roland Garros, because some players have more question marks than others. Some, like for instance, Alcaraz, we haven't seen play yet, and so it's just cool for us analysts to get some more insight on, like, you know, who's in form, who's not, how much can we actually read into these results come Roland Garros, and yeah, it's always fun to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And since we added, like, I think that you touched on a very interesting question about, like, some tournaments give more information than others. And I mentioned that Charleston and just now Stuttgart, which are both 500 events, Stuttgart being an indoor event, even though it's on red clay, and Charleston a while back in the U.S. on Hartrue, the famous green clay. So what do you make of those? Like, do you think that those tournaments actually give any insight? Are they minor in terms of the progression towards Roland Garros, because we also obviously had like Collins winning Charleston, which was really huge, and then we also had like the clashes between Świątek, Raducanu, Kostiuk, Goff, Sabalenka losing early, and Rybakina beating Świątek as well, and then going on to win the title. Of course, Sabalenka still. We don't really know to what extent she's still psychologically still a little bit shaken due to recent events in her personal life. But yeah, what do you say of those events?
Yeah, like, I mean, the first half of the WTA's clay season is always really interesting because you have wonderful tournaments in Charleston and Stuttgart that are just so well attended. You know, the organization is amazing. Like, the players win a Porsche for winning in Stuttgart, you know. Which, funny enough, Rybakina couldn't actually ride because she doesn't have a driver's license, which I found hilarious. But going back to the tennis, also Charleston, I mean, like, it's like one of the most historic venues, like, goes back like over 100 years. So like, the players love it, and it's like such great, especially for the players in Miami who just like it's pretty close by. So it's an easier kind of seamless type of transition into the clay. It plays nothing like Roland Garros clay because it's green, it's hard true, and it's, you know, it's more hard courtish than clay courtish. If you like, with minor adjustments in terms of sliding. But like tournaments like Stuttgart, Madrid, and even Charleston, they're not quite like, you know, Roland Garros type because they're not sea level clay, red clay, European clay that, like, you know, you feel like for for the top female players, it's mostly like Rome and Roland Garros that are like very similar. For the men, you know, at least you have Barcelona and Monte Carlo. So that gives at least, you know, some more data points for the top players. But like Collins backing up the run in Miami by going and winning in Charleston immediately, like 2 days later, like playing at the three setter against someone's Jude Moore, which is the only set of the tournament that she actually dropped. From then on, she just steamrolled, you know, some really, really good competition and like was barely losing games against players like Mertens, Kazakina in the final. I mean, it was just quality wins. And I guess it's just the confidence, you know, from winning Miami and also just that it's her last year that she feels like, you know, she can just leave it all out there. And she's always been a very like capable player, particularly on the return, super aggressive. And she brings that swagger to the court every single time against the top players. And she like fears no one. But to see her like do it from hard to clay, I thought was really impressive. And it's now very interesting because, you know, understandably, she didn't play Stuttgart. And now she's coming into Madrid and she's still fourth at the race. So like we're kind of seeing her as like, you know, maybe the next tier of like top players and like with a really good chance to keep it going potentially with Madrid being, you know, fast and it kind of rewarding her hyper aggressive game style. So I'm really looking forward to see what she does because she's also in the same section of the draw as Sabalek and I would love to see a fourth round match between them. Obviously Sabalek still has to win two matches, Collins as well. So I hope we get that match because yeah, I would just love to see Collins. We saw Collins versus Swiatek already in Australia. That was awesome. And also in Indian Wells. So I want to see Collins play against all the top players before she leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, same. Like, I really want to see more of Collins, like, as much as we can. I was, like, talking yesterday during a live and talking tennis with Nick, and there was, like, the questions of whether how much Collins really wants to place her importance of this season at the clay season. And it's just a bit of a... it's always a question mark, I guess, like, with players that are close to retirement, just because... she can either try to maximize her chances of like trying to win back in the either grass season or most probably the hard court season in the summer where it's going to lead up to the US Open. And she plays really well in the US, as we know, but she's also played incredibly in Australia, even against the home favorite in Barty back in that final in 2021, I want to say.
22.
Yeah. But yeah, also there's also the fact that she's retiring, so she will never really go back to those tournaments if she misses them this time around. So I would probably lean on saying that she probably, I think Nick said that or I said, I don't remember exactly, but that she probably will just try to make the most of her opportunities there. Remains to be seen like how far will she get, but yeah, it's been a very interesting story as well, a very feel good story. She can still keep winning big tournaments now on clay, that'll be pretty fascinating. But I guess like you got like the stories of Swiatek and Rybakina. I guess like those are probably the current front runners on the clay. What do you think about it? Like I was thinking as well, like how much weight do we want to put into the Stuttgart win that Rybakina had on Swiatek in regards to obviously the French Open.
Yeah, I think for some Stuttgart winners in the past, like you know, you've seen Kvitova, Pliskova, and they've made some semifinals. They've done well at Roland Garros. They've been great players, but with Rybakina, I really feel like she's an all-surface player. I think that her game can transcend on clay as well as it does on harder grass. I used to think of her more as a hardened grass player, but then I'm looking at her Roland Garros results, and they're sneaky really good because 2021 she beat Serena, and she lost 9-7 in the third to Pavlyuchenkova, who almost won the tournament. So. And that was 2021, where, you know, she's a completely different player now. And last year, she wasn't even given the chance to really continue in the tournament because, unfortunately, she got COVID in the third and had to pull out of the third round match. And we might as well have seen her go deep, given also the consistency she had last year. So I think Stuttgart, obviously, great venue for her. But honestly, she's just a really great player. Like, I'm watching her play Swiatek in this semifinal. And obviously, they built a really nice rivalry. And she always gives Iga a lot of trouble, particularly also... she's beaten her like three times last year. One of them was a retirement win, of course, in Rome, but still like she ended up coming back winning. And in this match, I thought she really stepped up and played like some really aggressive tennis. And like off the return, like Swiatek was a little confused on what to do, on how to return, Rybakina's first serve. Like she was standing so far in and Rybakina managed to save like 13 out of 15 break points. And just the first strike tennis that she plays, I think, really catches Swiatek off guard, even on clay, because of how well, like, Rybakina is able to extend points and how cleanly she was hitting her backhand as well, like, rushing Iga. And it was just, it was really, really a problem-solving type match where Iga had to dig super deep even to get the second set. And I always felt like Rybakina was the one in control because, you know, it always kind of depended on how well she served. Like, if she served really high for serve percentage, I felt like Iga was having to scrap for her service games, but Rybakina was holding really easily, so it kept, like, compounding the pressure on Iga, and it just, you know, she played amazing in the third set. I actually didn't think Iga did that much wrong, particularly. It was just a matter of her, like, figuring out how to adjust her return position, how to get more more out of her serve. But I think overall, like, actually for Iga, you know, a lot was made about, like, the 10-match win streak in Stuttgart and all that. I always felt like this is a venue where she might be more susceptible on the clay because, you know, it is more slick and fast and it is indoors. And I felt like, you know, she had some tests earlier in 2022 and 2023, but she just surpassed them. Like, she lost a set to Pliskova last year. It was kind of a similar type of player in that, like, she's a big server, flat ball striker. And then the year before that, Samsonova, where she was on that, like, 37-match win streak, she almost lost to Samsonova there. So she's managed to keep it alive, but I felt like, you know, she might be more vulnerable here, even though she had that, you know, perfect win streak. So it just makes Madrid and Roland Garros, like, more interesting. I think if Rybakina is able to beat Iga in Rome, now it's like, whoa, okay, like, because if she's able to beat her on slow clay as well, that makes it really, really interesting going into Roland Garros. But honestly, like, she probably still is one of the 3-4 favorites. I wouldn't be shocked to see her in the semis or final of RG. I think Iga still wants to avoid Rybakina, even on slow clay.
What do you, because we also had this discussion, and I saw on Twitter, the big hitting type of thing with Iga Swiatek, and the discussion of, like, whether it's an everyone problem or is mostly an Iga problem. Somebody also mentioned the low bounce. It could be just like she has trouble with low bounce courts. Case in point would be just the grass. Iga strikes me as like first strike tennis, like, in the sense, like, after the serve's passed, she tries to take control of the rally as aggressively as she can, and she will go for winners very often, like, down the line, just cross court, but especially trying to get the forehand, but even the backhand, like, she tries to buy winners very often. So what do you think troubles really when she plays? I guess, like, let's put Rybakina specifically, because she plays well against Sabalenka. She kind of, like, has her own issues, but Rybakina seems to just get under her skin a little bit more than Sabalenka does for some reason.
Yeah, I think so. I think Rybakina is the toughest opponent for Iga, and tougher than Sabalenka mostly. Against, you know, Sabalenka, they have these really high octane baseline rallies that go, that are more longer in length, like in Madrid. You know, they're just kind of going toe to toe, and they're personally more enjoyable for me to watch because you have, like, that contrast and the bunches. I mean, you have the contest in Rybakina and Swiatek as well, but, like, in Sabalenka and Iga, it's just like an all out hitting contest, and they both want to be in charge. But Iga tends to do better in that one because she's also dealing with, like, a heavier ball, and Rybakina, whereas, you know, I mean, Sabalenka, whereas Rybakina hits it more straight and low, and it's, like, just really hard for Iga to, like, maintain her balance. But honestly, like, Rybakina's edge, like, in the first serve, I feel like it just makes it really hard for Iga to feel like she has an answer on the return. And it's, like, every single time there was a break point, it was, like, unreturned serve, ace, you know, next. And it was just, like, it's that, like, unfazed nature of Rybakina that I think also, like, mentally just creeps into Swiatek in her service games. But their matchup is, like, there's only 2 or 3 players that can really do this to Iga. Like, you know, there's Ostapenko, there's Rybakina. Ostapenko is more of, like, sort of an anomaly. They're not meeting very often. But, you know, every time they do, obviously, Penko is just in her own league. Like, there's just no one comparable to the way that she plays it. But, like, Rybakina is able to just take the racket out of her hands and just rush Iga on the first strike like no other, like, on the second serve return. The way that Iga is just always on the back foot. I often find, like, when they're playing these longer baseline rallies, Rybakina just doesn't fear Iga. Like, she's able to just take all of her blows and just redirect down the line, boom, and, like, get out of trouble with the serve. It just feels like Iga's having to search for answers. And because I feel like when she gets her athleticism into play and she gets into longer rallies, then she can really move Rybakina around. And then that movement difference is clear on clay, right? But like Rybakina just doesn't allow that to really happen. And I think part of the problem is Iga likes to be in control and she just blitzes through most of her opponents. So she's usually, like you said, the one dominating, like from the center of the court, like just spreading the play and seems really comfortable. But when she plays Rybakina, she's trying to sort of fight fire with fire sometimes. And so I feel like she's trying to show that like I'm the superior one and I can kind of play this style. But instead, I'd like to see her like sort of brought back on the return of serve, like look more bolts back in, like use her amazing athleticism and speed, because that's what really separates her from most of the other top players, I feel like. So if she can use those maybe to her advantage a little bit more, that would be more interesting. But it's hard for her. I think it's always going to be somewhat of a concern just because Shantik like still doesn't get that much out of her first serve, like as amazing and generational as everything else is. That's still probably the one part of her game that just kind of, it makes it so everything else has to be really good and really perfect. Mm-hmm. And when you're playing a really top player like Rybakina, it just like shrinks the margin a little bit, you know?
Yeah. If you attack, like for example, if you compare it to Goff, who has also been on a, not necessarily on her best form, but still like scraping by on her wins and just like using the most of her incredible mental game, like, Goff is like one of the players that
like she plays so many three setters, and I feel like Shantik never does. So she's in a position of like suddenly having to play 2 hours, 15 minutes, 3 hours, and Buckner's like, I've been doing this for like 2 weeks already, so I feel more at home.
Yeah, and the one thing that Goff I think does that Shantik just kind of has a reluctance to do is playing a very defensive style of tennis. Like, I think Goff can really rip on really both the forehand and the backhand, even though she can spray some errors sometimes on the forehand. She tends to has had a tendency to be very aggressive with that shot lately, but she can just kind of be comfortable as like being back of the court, as like using her athleticism. It was in full display back in the US Open final last year against Sabalenka. I think Świątek just really has this reluctance to like step back a little and just kind of try to play some defense attempts.
I think she really needs to like cede a little bit of control and take a page out of Coco's book. They're just so right, because she also has an extreme grip just like Coco, but she rips it and Coco rolls it a bit more and gets more loop and height and resets the rallies. I feel like if Shante can use that looping forehand a little bit and reset some of these rallies and then get into a more like high margin situation where she's able to find a shorter ball, then she's like in much better position. I saw her do that quite even in the second set here. Like she was able to, once she realized, like, okay, I can actually loop the ball in and play a little bit more defensively, like, that might actually help me, because it's, like, otherwise you're just kind of playing into Rybakina's strike zone, because she loves the hitting contest. It's a little bit like Alcaraz and Sinner, like, in Indian Wells. Like, what flipped the match is just, you know, all that variety, like, Carlos, like, just slowing down the pace and giving, these loopier, higher balls and breaking Sinner's contact point, because in that matchup also, Sinner has the edge on the serve and the return. It's kind of similar to the Świątek-Rybakina matchup as well. Like, Rybakina is the taller player, but slightly slower. The more Alcaraz and Świątek can use those athleticism skill sets that they have that separate themselves, it feels like they might be able to, you know, win some of those matches. Because like for Rybakina and Sinner, you know, there's just some parallels there, right? There's a lot of differences as well, but I see some parallels.
Excited to see those tweets with those crazy parallels with birthdays and weird numbers that you come up with sometimes.
Yeah. My mind works in mysterious ways sometimes when I'm thinking tennis and parallels and, stats.
Well, that's why you have, 10,000 followers now?
Yeah, that's actually some of the reasons why I started the Iga and Carlos show, because I started to randomly come up with some of these parallels for Iga and Carlos, and I realized, actually they're similar and very different in some ways, and it would be cool to kind of do a joint pod.
I guess one of the stories of the week, I guess on the WTA side, was obviously Kostyuk. We also had some Raducanu, if you want to spill some thoughts on her her progression. But Kostyuk has just kind of exploded, I guess. Like this year she's been playing really well. I think that one of the things that I was most surprised with was how her ranking isn't higher, even though she's now Well, I didn't check the rankings this week, but she was 27 as of last week. So she wasn't seeded.
21.
Stuttgart. Yeah, 21, yeah. So it's definitely something that is going to be better for her instead of like meeting like all of those like top 10, top 20 players like from the second round on. But yeah, like she's been showing like some good form lately. She had a good run in Australia, if I remember correctly. Now just coming out here, reaching the final. Probably ran out of gas a little against Rybakina, who was also playing like overly well. Yeah. But yeah, like.
Yeah, you're right. Like, she's been really consistent this year. Seventh in the race, but also, like, some of her biggest results. Australian Open quarters, San Diego final, Indian Wells semi. And, like, she's seventh in the race, but she didn't even play. Like, she withdrew from Dubai and withdrew from Miami with injuries. So, like, that's seventh, having left, like, 2,000 points on the table. That's pretty impressive, I would say, like, for her. I always felt like she had the capability because I always feel like she had the complete game. Like, when it comes to her technique and her shot making, there isn't really anything that makes me think like, oh, that's a bit tight to her eye, you know. And I always felt like she had that tight game, but it just like in her head, like mental game, I felt like, you know, she was very emotional and kind of, she's been through a lot with the Ukraine stuff as well the last couple of years, so that I think maybe slowed down the progress a little bit. It's weird that she's been around forever. She's only 21 years old, like the oldest 21-year-old probably ever in tennis. Because she, like, first broke through, I remember in 2018, she made, like, the third round of the Australian Open, she was 15. And so we've been talking about her for a really long time. But now, like, I think it's finally starting to come together. She has a new coach as well. But I keep forgetting her name. It starts with a Z. But, like, but yeah, she's been with her, like, since middle of last year. And, like, I think, yeah, she's coached some other top players in the past. So it seems to be kind of working. And she seems, like, unbelievably fit, like to play four matches in a row. Like her strength is very clear. Like she's an elite defender, and she has this like amazing tier one athleticism, like along with Goff and Swiatek. And like I definitely put her like in terms of the way like she can cover shots with like slides on clay, and the way she's like some of the balls that she's getting back, like those matches that she played against Zhang Shenwen where she saved like five match points, and then like that crazy matches against Goff where like, you know, they play each other in the Australian Open and it was just like a really messy match, but I can understand because of the heat and like the way their games kind of match up with each other. Like it's not the most pretty tennis. There's a lot of errors, but it feels like you're still like kind of on a knife's edge. It was one of those matches where, yeah, like someone had to win in the end.
It's like it's like immovable object meets immovable object.
Yeah. It was like, who's actually going to, you know, because it was really tight, very nervy, but it is one of those matches that was enthralling for those reasons rather than like the sustained quality necessarily. But that was also true in Stuttgart. And then, you know, like on the eighth match point, she finally gets it done. And I'm thinking she's probably going to run out of gas at some point. But then she beats, you know, she goes like 3 hours against Sigmund, like 3 hours again against Zhang, and then Goff. And then Vondrousova was actually the easier match for her, which was, you know, somewhat of a reprieve, hopefully, like, for the final to be competitive. But then, yeah, like, Rybakina just played amazing and, like, Kostyuk ran out of gas and that. But, yeah, honestly, yeah, like, do you think Kostyuk can, like, potentially, if she keeps this up, because the year is still really long, but do you think, like, maybe she can break into the top 10 this year if she keeps playing like this?
I mean, if she keeps playing like this, she's already seventh in the race. It's going to take some time. And now getting up in the rankings is probably going to help her. Like, as I said, like not go head on first against the top players like in the earlier rounds. So if she keeps her form, she can definitely beat many, many other players. And she's probably just going to come in a little even fresher. What would have happened, for example, if she was fresher against Rybakina? Maybe the final would have like taken a different turn. Maybe she would have been able to find more answers. If she only had to play, for example, Goff in the semifinals, or just Vondrousova instead, and just kind of had her only like less, you know, with less top players on the way. I think she could have gone, you know, done better than that. But and I think that's one of the things that, for example, for the 2 week tournaments that are coming about. It's probably going to be a big help for players who, like Makostyuk, played several marathon matches, because it's not like a back-to-back 1 week tournament. It's like you have to play almost every day And now she's obviously seeded with the 32 seed in Madrid with like 128 spaces draw, so like 32 seeds, 96 players, and she's gonna have a day off between every match, so she's gonna be able to recover while getting match practice and just getting, you know, some things going on. I think that by Roland Garros, I'm not saying that she's going to be in top 10 by Roland Garros, but I would say that she could even like break inside of the top 20, top 15, even by then, if she keeps playing that well, and with some draw lenience towards her. But yeah, towards the end of the year, definitely, I could definitely see her qualifying even for the finals.
Yeah, I kind of felt like this was a long time coming for her, but nice to see her put it all together, because I do think the game has always been there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on the ATP side, since you've already drew a few comparisons between Alcaraz, Swiatek, and...
You obviously
there's one more thing. Kostic's coach, her name is Sandra Saniweska. So she's, I knew it started with a Z. I just couldn't remember the... She used to be coached by her mom for a long time, but now...
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, Sandra's...
Just that she breaking away from moms or parents tends to be difficult in professional tennis. Moms and dads, parents in general, are tough to break away from. But yeah, that's glad it's working. At least it's going to show her that she can kind of like go her own way in that regard. And,
because just something else, like emotionally, you know, she's always been very, very emotional after every single point that she's lost. And it's kind of... affected her mentality, because it's like bled into the rest of her game, like her confidence, and I felt like it lingered for too long, but now she gets upset, she accepts it, but she moves on quicker. So I think that's the difference. Like, she still gets really frustrated and emotional, but she's able to kind of reset and actually use that as fuel to play better. So that seems to help her.
Yeah, totally agree. I definitely saw a lot of that this week, especially like playing Zhang and Gao. It was extremely crucial. Yeah, like we had on the men's side, Barcelona and Monte Carlo happened. I think Monte Carlo and Barcelona had their own like sort of like distinct narratives in the sense. Like, we had like Monte Carlo, we had like Djokovic, kind of first time since the loss in his opening round in the opening round or third round in Indian Wells.
Second match,
yeah. And then he just kind of came here and came back there in Monte Carlo and lost to Casper Ruud. And then we had also Jannik Sinner, who lost to Tsitsipas. And I think that was probably like the final that nobody really expected. Even though Djokovic hasn't really been playing his best tennis, once he got into the groove, everybody probably expected him to like kind of routine or, you know, not have too much trouble against Ruud. I would have expected like a 7-5, 6-4 type of situation in that semi.
Yeah, I thought going into that one that Djokovic would start to slowly elevate, because he played a very good first match against Safiulin, but then he really started to struggle physically in his next two matches against Musetti and Dimitar Musetti, and of course beaten him last year in Monte Carlo. And traditionally, the last 8-9 years, Djokovic hasn't started out super strong in the clay season. Like, he sort of built his way into form, and you know, usually he's coming to Monte Carlo having won Australia or won Dubai, usually Australia, because he's so dominant there. So at least, you know, everyone kind of knew that, okay, he's not going to be probably playing his best. So, but that was actually his best result at Monte Carlo, like, since he won in 2016, funny enough, the semis. So on one hand, I'm like feeling kind of positive about it. But then on the other hand, I'm like, okay, but he still lost to Nardi. He lost to the semis to Sinner. So it hasn't been an ideal year for him to not have a title by now. Mm-hmm. But it was weird, because once Djokovic took that second set against Ruud, and Ruud came out like playing much more authoritative and aggressive like he has been all year, so it felt like Ruud's best chance to, you know, make a dent at Djokovic or take a set or maybe even get the win. But then what really surprised me is the first three games of the third set, where I thought Ruud played phenomenal. Like, he just started hitting his backhand on the line, played super aggressive. The backhand on the line is super key for Ruud, because he always wants to get his forehand into play, and if he can be more aggressive on that shot, then he's not having to defend on it, and then he's much better off, you know, being the one in control and dictating with the heavy forehand rather than having to defend off the backhand and play so far behind the baseline like he was for most of last year, aside for the French Open. So I think that was a real block for him to getting like a big win over a top three player. So he finally did that because Djokovic still came back after those billion three games and he still had to hold for 5-4 after being up 4-1, getting it back to 4-all for Djokovic. So, and then like Djokovic kind of played a couple of really bad points to start the game. He missed like some, he missed an easy overhead. And then like,
the one that he tried to do a drop shot on the overhead.
Yeah, that one. And then like missed a swing volley after that in the final game when he was serving to stay in the match. So overall, I think Djokovic can be pretty happy that he got four matches in. I'm not that surprised that he pulled out of Madrid, just given that he hasn't like wanted to play that event in a long time. Like, he played it in 2022, didn't play it last year, didn't play it in 2021. I think he sort of feels like the conditions are very similar to Roland Garros, and he kind of wants, he'd rather just use that time to get more physically in shape. Well, then Olympics, like surface change again. And obviously we know Olympics and Roland Garros are like the main goals. So I wasn't too surprised. I think if he had lost earlier in Monte Carlo, he would have maybe gone to Madrid. But actually the 2 years that I mentioned, 2021 and 2023, that he skipped Madrid, he won Roland Garros. So maybe there's something to that. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he does in Rome. But for Casper and Stefanos, really great 2 weeks for them. I'm really pleased that...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
They're back in the mix because they've always been really good clay courters. I mean, they've been Roland Garros finalists, and it feels like there's opportunity for them right now because Sinner, you know, we still haven't seen him best of five on clay. That's, he's sort of been unproven in that sense, and we kind of put him in tier one because of the amazing like 6 months that he's had. So we just kind of assume that those parts will translate better to clay. But Alcaraz is still hurt with a forearm injury. He's supposed to play in Madrid. But, you know, not great signs because he hasn't really been able to train and been able to hit forehands. And then, of course, Rafa, like, not the same player that he was. And then Djokovic, there's some question marks. So there's a really good opportunity for guys like Rod and Tsitsipas. And so it's really cool that they played these back-to-back finals and they reversed the results. And, you know, they each won one final and they came through the players they were supposed to, because I genuinely think there's opportunity. I would be pretty surprised if they didn't, you know, continue this throughout the whole clay season, because I think they're real contenders now. I can put them just behind, you know.
I was really impressed by both Rude and Tsitsipas. Tsitsipas has been having like not his not so great time of his career right now, like this past couple of months. Like the Monte Carlo title was almost a bit of a surprise in a sense, like not so much because we know that he's great on clay, and he's already won this tournament twice. That was now his third time winning it. Which for me makes it like a sort of like a baby Guga Kuerten, like winning Garros three times now. Winning,
it's crazy. Only Rafa has won it more times now than Steph. Yeah. Like 11-3, but still like three is
pretty good. Like
More than Djokovic, who has two. So it's pretty wild.
Yeah. And
but you're so right. Like coming into Monte Carlo, he was 25th in the race. He was having a terrible time. He had lost to Shapovalov and Miami and just like was a shell of himself and like had lost to the Hechka. And like they were just a lot of results where like we weren't really talking about him. He was kind of not a factor anymore. He was outside the top 10. You know, he had that injury at the end of last year. He pulled out of the World Tour Finals. And like usually he plays well in Australia, but he couldn't really get a chance to do that. The preparation wasn't ideal. So like this was a very, very important win for him because, you know, if he doesn't like stamp himself on these slow clay courts, then it's trouble for him because this is where I really feel like this is where he's at his best, where he's able to protect the backhand a bit better. He has so much more time. His tennis becomes a lot more creative and inventive as well. And He's such a great athlete as well. The forehand, when he moves into the corner on clay, it's scary good. And obviously, he has the serve and the net play, and the all-round game is always excellent on the clay. So, yeah, like, he was awesome in Monte Carlo, honestly. Like, the match against, particularly the match against Zverev, when I saw him beat Echeverry 1-0, that's when I was like, oh, okay, he's coming. Because Echeverry is an awesome clay court player, so if you only lose one game against him, you're probably playing really well.
He played really well against Ruud, I believe, in the semifinals at Barcelona, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. He pushed him. It was like 6-4. It was a very good match. So, like, in Echeverry quarters last year, Roland Garros, like, he's been to a couple of clay court finals. So that was a really quality win. And then against Zverev, he was up 7-5, 5-love. And he almost bageled Zverev in the second set. And then Zverev comes all the way back. It's 5-all. Like, you know, it was a bit nervy at the end. But then Tsitsipas plays a great tiebreak. And then the match that everyone was talking about against Sinner, which, you know, like, he comes out, he plays an amazing first set. He has this 5-3 head-to-head against Sinner, but we haven't really seen post-puke Sinner, if you like, since Beijing, you know, like, since he really, like, post-US Open became, like, the best player. So we hadn't seen that versus a healthy version of Steph. So I was really curious to see how that would pan out. And then, like, Steph, you know, played an amazing first set. And then, like, Sinner was the better player for most of the match after that. And then there was that, obviously, a little controversial line call at 3-1. You know, Sinner had a break point to go up double break. And I do think if he goes up double break, he probably wins that match for sure. We don't know for sure, but, like, he was in a very good position. And the umpire, like, didn't see yet. It was, the serve was, like, 7 centimeters out. Sinner, like, plays the point, and then he points to the mark. And, like, Hawkeye on TV shows that it's out, but it was never called. So a bit of a reprieve there, because then after that, Sinner also got hurt, struggled a little bit with cramps, we later found out. And so, yeah, that makes me question, like, you know, we haven't seen Sinner totally pushed on clay yet in a really big match, and how his body reacts physically. So I was still impressed by Tsitsipas that he was able to recover, started to come back from a breakdown. But you could clearly see Sinner was a bit hampered, like, when he was moving to his forehand side. And, you know, I thought Steph took advantage of that and, like, managed to come through it. So a little bit of help, but still really well deserved, I thought. Like, because then in the final he was terrific. But I didn't think Ruud played well. So that was interesting.
Yeah. I think in both finals, like Barcelona and Monte Carlo, like, just kind of the reverse of each other. We had, like, a pretty solid set, like, up until, like, 5-all or 6-5 in the Barcelona final. And then after that, like, Tsitsipas, I don't think he made the best decisions, like, going to the net as often. But he also probably ran a bit out of steam. Like, the second set was just, like, all the way Ruud, and Tsitsipas kind of, like, faded out a bit. But I was very, as you were saying, like, I was very impressed with the Ruud's backhand, and also
it was so good backhand.
It was both of them have been hitting their backhands phenomenally. I think Tsitsipas, for the reasons you mentioned before, like, game slows down a little bit, has a bit more time to set up. Maybe it's a little bit of the same for Ruud, but, like, it's just, like, the willingness to go for that shot a lot more. And it's just something that was, like, really lacking. And it was just, like, so loopy before, and it was just, like, really not even, it was like a bad neutral shot, if you will. It wasn't.
Yeah, it would just put too much, and he'd kind of drift way behind the baseline. Now he's, like, actually taking it on the rise a bit more, flattening it out, stepping into it better. So I definitely think he made that adjustment, and I also thought he started attacking Tsitsipas's forehand to open up the backhand a bit better. Like, he started hitting the inside-in forehand as opposed to the inside-out, because, you know, Tsitsipas always loves to cheat a little bit to his left, because he's looking for the runaround forehand. He wants to hit forehands in the outside, because that's where he feels like he can do a lot of damage and come forward. And, like, Ruud was like, okay, I'm going to challenge you to your strength, and then I'm going to make you defend on the weakness. So I thought that was a good adjustment. And he also started taking the returns a lot more earlier. Like, in Monte Carlo, he was so far behind the baseline when returning. And so what that did is it let Steph do his serve and volley, especially on second serves. And so Tsitsipas saved 8 out of 8 break points in the Monte Carlo match, which he won 1-4. And Ruud was just too passive. He let Tsitsipas do all the dictating, and Tsitsipas was really good at it. But then in Monte Carlo, in Barcelona, as you said, like, I think the fatigue caught up to Steph a little bit. His footwork wasn't quite as sharp. I still thought he played, like, a decent match. It was, like, average Steph, you know? It wasn't, like, a bad match from him. But it was just, you could tell, like, he was trying to finish points a little bit sooner. He was, you know, not maybe as prepared to fight as hard, which I totally get, because he played 6 matches in Monte Carlo and then, like, scrapped his way to the final. Like, he wasn't playing his best the whole week. He had to save 2 match points against Facundo Diaz Acosta in the quarters. And then he went 3 sets against Lajovic. Whereas Ruud, like, he played straight sets And he played quality opponents, Ruud. Like, you meet Arnaldi, and you mentioned Echeverry, really quality player in the semis. So I thought Ruud was, for him to not drop a set and win that tournament was pretty big. Also, his first 500 title. So now you can get rid of the label as a 250 king, especially when he had all these other ridiculous achievements aside from those titles. So yeah, it was really fitting. Tsitsipas still has a really bizarre stat, 0-11 against, you know, in 500 finals. But I guess for him, it's less significant because he's won 3D Monte Carlos and he's won the year-end finals. So if you have that, then it's not as significant, in my opinion, narratively. But for Ruud, it was a much bigger deal. And I'm really happy that they split the matches. And, you know, it's kind of, I feel like they can keep it going. And yeah, I'm really curious. Just, I hope they can keep it going at Roland Garros because I think one of them can make the semis at least.
Yeah. And they played really well. I think every year they really just kind of play well in at the French. They obviously not necessarily like Ruud reaching the final twice. He was the
final. Actually, the last three finals has featured one of them, right? Because
yeah, exactly.
Last year and the year before, and Steph two sets to level one Djokovic the year before, 3 years ago now. So, wow. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I still think there's like if Djokovic, Sinner, and Alcaraz play their best, I still think they beat them,
yeah,
of course. But like after that, yeah, I think that probably put Steph and Ruud in the same category. Maybe Tsitsipas a teeny bit higher right now, but that's just because we've seen him pull off some really big wins on clay in the past. But Ruud is very close. Like,
what do you think of Nadal's form right now? I saw a bit of his match against I forget his first round opponent in Barcelona.
Yeah, Flavio Caboli. To be honest, that one was very weird. Like, because I think Caboli was overawed by the occasion. And he definitely didn't play anywhere near his best level. Like, he made 27 unforced errors in the first set. And I don't think Rafa was tested as a result of that. So I didn't really get to see how well Rafa is moving because I felt like the heaviness of Rafa's forehand was too overwhelming for Caboli to deal with. So I didn't feel like physically he was tested enough for me to really gauge where he was at. But against Demonor, I was impressed by the first set because I thought Rafa was able to physically hang with him and he made it competitive. He had a break point for 5-3. But then Demonor is just so good defensively. He has so many questions of you, especially this year. Like how much he shrinks the court when he's just everywhere. And like he was also just a lot better at taking his backhand earlier than Caboli was and like going down the line with it. And he was always pinning Nadal in the backhand corner and then going to the drop shot. And the telltale was that Rafa wasn't moving as well as he normally does. Like physically, I don't think he had the match fitness yet. So, like, he was playing very cautiously. Like, he wasn't going after his serve because he hasn't been practicing that serve because it did abdominal injury. So, he was basically very predictable with it, always going slice wide. We're basically just spinning it in and getting the points on it. It was almost like watching 2005 to 2007 Nadal, except this time without the physicality and the movement.
Yeah.
So, it made it doubly hard. So, basically, Nadal just had to rely on his ball striking and his forehand, which is still there. Like, he can still strike the ball amazingly well, but the movement and the serve are the big question marks right now. So, yeah, he just badly needs, like, some matches, like, you know, in Madrid and Rome, if he can get two or three in each tournament. And hopefully the goal is just be healthy so he can finish on a good note at Roland Garros. Not so much, like, can he win it, but more just so, like, hope he can play it, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess the goal of Barcelona was just, like, don't get injured and get a couple of matches in. So and from that standpoint, I guess you could say it's somewhat of a success. Because, like, he can build on this, I feel like, if he doesn't hurt himself again.
Yeah. Do you think that those questions are enough, like, to just say, like, there's absolutely no chance that Nadal wins the French Open this year?
Honestly, like, because it's Nadal and because he's won it 14 times and because there's this, like, aura of invincibility that he has, like, I can just, like, not really count him out ever. Like, I just feel like if he's healthy enough and he's able to play, you know, somewhat decent, like, I think he can play a really good match against a top player and then, like, be really satisfied, you know? Like, if he can just do that. Like, he's, yeah, like, I can't really put him in any kind of tier or, like, assess, like, what he's going to do. But just because of his record there, he'll probably just, you know, he'll probably just win a first couple of rounds just on aura alone, depending on the draw, right? So I feel like he can just, you know, just rely on that. Because, like, I also think, like, 2 years ago, like, we weren't giving him that much. We weren't making him as, like, the main favorite. A lot of people weren't because he had the foot problem. And then he didn't play, like, Madrid and Rome, and like he or he skipped Barcelona, Monte Carlo, and he was like getting injections after every single match. But there, at least he had the confidence from having won Australia, having won Acapulco, like winning 20 matches in a row. But this time he hasn't played any matches in over a year. So the situation is just so different where just want him to like retire on the court as opposed to like.
And he's going to be unseated, right? So that's going to make things even more.
And actually, I saw that he's playing the Labor Cup this year as well. So it makes Federer type farewell because Roger's tournament. And maybe that makes, maybe he is planning to play after Roland Garros after all. Let's see.
Yeah. I mean, there was the rumors that he maybe would have wanted to try to and make it to the Olympics, although he's like a very outside chance of this. But yeah,
because he has to qualify, right?
Because I don't know exactly what's the rules of qualifying for the Olympics, but there are rules.
Yeah, so maybe that's on his mind, but and also because it's held at Roland Garros literally, so it makes it very tempting to want to keep playing afterwards. Try to play
them. Yeah, like maybe he wants to like take a page out of Roger's book and say like, hey, listen, it was an amazing farewell. I'm gonna do it exactly the same at the Labor Cup.
Maybe he can play doubles
out of retirement.
Yeah, pull him out of retirement for just one doubles match, and then just like that would be awesome. I kind of want that now. Put it down into existence.
I almost feel like they could just do it like for an exhibition inside of the exhibition. I think
he played that one exhibition with Alcaraz in Vegas, but it was kind of the same. Like he couldn't really serve, and the movement wasn't the same. So, I mean, honestly, if you had told me like Nadal would still be trying to go for Roland Garros at 38, mm-hmm. I'd probably laugh like 10 years ago because I was one of those people that didn't think he would be able to play much past 30. I just didn't believe it because he played so physically, and I just thought there's no way like his body would hold up. And then he won 8 more majors, so I couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, after his first big injury in 2009, I was like one of those guys that were like, yeah, he's done. There's like, you can't just have injuries on both knees and come out of this like the same player. He didn't. He actually came out better. it's not Nadal for you.
And then like the first round of Madrid, because the draw is already out, he's playing Darwin Blanche. Blanche is born in 2007. Like, so by the time Blanche was born, like Nadal already had 3 Roland Garros. It's wild. Like there's the 21 year age gap between them. And it's like, he's like 16 and Rafa's almost 38. It's pretty crazy. And actually, if he wins that, then he'll play Alex de Minaur again. So that'll be a good, maybe apples to apples.
Man, de Minaur is really just kind of getting in the way of all these big four guys playing.
Yeah, he beat Djokovic at the United Cup.
And just, of course, like no need to mention his record against Andy Murray.
Yeah, but I also feel like he's improved generally quite a lot as a player. Like he's really up to ceiling to where, like number 11 feels correct.
And I guess like there's a final few notes. I guess just a question. Do you have any favorites for Roland Garros in either the men's or the women's side? I feel like this year is like a little bit tougher to tell. Would still probably put like Świątek as the big favorite.
Women's side is more clear with Iga, like still having an edge over the field, even though, Rybakina is putting herself on there. But Sabalenka is the big question, right? Because Sabalenka, since Australia, she's 4-4, but she has this amazing record right now of peaking at the majors and like 6 semifinals in a row. And she almost could have done even better than she did last year, having won Australia, but then those tight losses against Jabeur and match point against Bohova in the semis. So honestly, I can't rule her out as well going on a deep run. I just really want to see more matches between Iga, Arena, and Elena, and Coco. Like, the more matches we get in Madrid and Rome between them, the better. But I would still put Iga as the top favorite. Like, she's won 3 of the 4 last years. And I still think it's her turf.
Yeah. For the men's side, I think I would have said Alcaraz before, but now with the injuries, it's just like a really big question mark. Djokovic, again, same as Djokovic, he probably still wants to kind of go for those Grand Slam records, but it's tough to tell like what kind of form he is in right now. But and there's obviously Sinner, but same reasons as you mentioned before, he hasn't really done he hasn't really been tested, especially on the five five sets on clay, which we only really get to have once a year. So since his breakthrough really came out after the US Open, it's obvious this is going to be the first time that we're going to see him there as the nail sinner, if you will, at 22 years old, yeah. 23, I guess.
Yeah, like he'll be number one seed for Madrid, so that would be interesting because Djokovic pulled out, and so yeah, maybe we'll get. Yeah, we'll see like how he kind of handled his end. Madrid is a little bit different with the altitude and stuff. I guess he also didn't play it last year, so it'll be interesting to follow. And then I hope Alcaraz is able to get it going because, yeah, that would be a shame. Like this is not ideal for him. Normally he's playing Barcelona and winning it, and then going into Madrid trying to defend it, two-time champion. But now, actually, maybe it'll be good if he's healthy and he doesn't even necessarily have to win Madrid. But if he can get, like, say, the quarters at least, and then, like, have a really good role, then, you know, then now we have a really solid top three, like, if they're all playing well. But yeah, maybe Tsitsipas and Rude will keep it going. But even they, like, because they did so well in Monte Carlo, Barcelona, I don't put that much stock into what they do in Madrid just because it's so quickly afterwards and they're going to have to adjust back to sea level anyway.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for some players now. And Madrid is always, like, pretty wild. Like, last year we had Struff getting to the final. Struff, by the way, getting his first ATP title at almost 34 years old. Great story, Dan. He did it in Munich where it was like almost, it was basically snowing all week. It was that cold. It was really cold, heavy conditions. And he's obviously a guy who can hit through it with his big power. But yeah, that was insane because he beat four really quality players to do it. He beat Bodig van Nissen on Schulp, and then he beat Felix. And then he beat Rune 6-2, 6-0 in a match that I really didn't get to watch because it was in the middle of the night for me. But I saw he beat him in 45 minutes, which is pretty insane. And then he saved three set points against Fritz in the final and won that in straights. So. And this is a guy who's just been searching for the first title, and everyone knew he's way too good to like not have a right title on his resume. So,
yeah.
And he's defending Madrid finals points because he was the finals last year and pushed Alcaraz. Like, it was a good final.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, that's a really cool thing.
Yeah. I think it's almost poetic justice in a sense that like he gets to win a title the week before where he almost very nearly won it last year. Like, imagine. When he first started as a Masters 1000, it would have been pretty epic. But it's great that he got to get some really good wins on his way to his Munich final, including obviously Rune, who was actually his first loss in Munich, I guess, of his career after winning the title two or three times in the past, I guess. So,
yeah, he won it the last couple of years. Yeah. But yeah, that's insane. Rune is another guy that I just don't know what to do with right now because he is so hard to read right now, like in terms of what version of him we get per set, per match. I have no idea. I don't think he does either. That sort of makes it really exciting. He's kind of still like really figuring out what his identity is as a player because I know he can kind of do it all, but he's also just very streaky right now. So he had a really good clay season last year, but this year I don't think I can put him in the same tier. Right? Like, so what I've seen so far, I can't really put him in the same tier as Tsitsipas and Rude.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, maybe it's, that's still brilliant piece, but we'll see.
Yeah, and I guess the real final note of the episode is that another player has closed the curtains on their career. Garbiñe Muguruza, former world number one, Wimbledon and Roland Garros champion, a WTA finals champion as well, 10 times titleist in the WTA tour. It's called their career. It just announced retirement, I think, 2 days ago. Which I missed on Twitter somehow. I just kind of, I think I logged in like way too quick and I just saw a couple of tweets and I was happy with it. Just didn't see it. Mostly I get my news from Twitter anyway. So, yeah, but yeah, it's a, just hope all the best for her. Obviously, like she has had a great career. It's one of those players that some people would have said probably kind of, left something to be desired. I would say she wasn't the most consistent throughout her entire career, but honestly, like when you close this chapter in your life and you look back, you just see that like the things that she's done, dream career for you know, every player. I'd say like there's very few players who can say that they achieved more than her in their lives, so men and women.
Yeah, she's obviously really young, but she's only 30.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that she beat Venus in the Wimbledon final and beat Serena in the Roland Garros final, like, that already is pretty amazing. There's no other player who's beaten both Williams sisters in major finals to do it. And also, Australian Open finalist, like you said, World Tour finalist, she's been number one for 4 weeks as well. So, and then also 3 1000s. So, like, and actually, like, she's won 10 titles, but 8 of them have been on hard courts, and then Roland Garros and Wimbledon. So, pretty, and yeah, she's a lot of first round losses, pretty streaky, but honestly, like, when she was on song, like, she was excellent to watch. Like, the way she was very explosive around the court, I remember, like, some of her peak performances, like, just super flat, powerful ground strokes, like, just dictating rallies. And, like, I remember 2021, she was pretty consistent, like, the whole year, finished in the top three. Just some really memorable moments against great players. But, like, seems like she was enjoying her life outside of tennis a lot, like, after 2021, and didn't like how the results in 2022, and then kind of it didn't come as a surprise to me. It was like when she announced that she's holding a press conference, I'm like, she's probably going to retire, because it seems like that. Like, I didn't think there was any intention of her wanting to come back based on social media, but that's, you know, that's good for her that she's really happy in her life and content with her awesome career. She's a Hall of Fame lock for sure in my eyes. So I think she's going to, yeah, she's definitely going to be missed, but she's had an amazing career. And, yeah, Spanish tennis. She also had that relationship with Conchita Martinez when she won the title in 2017. I remember that was a big one, because Martinez had been to a Wimbledon final before. And yeah, she really played those big matches very well, kind of like a Stan Wawrinka on the men's side, really.
Yeah, exactly.
With those majors, right? So,
it's a really good comparison, I'd say. If she had gone on to win the Australian Open, then you would have been the near exact comparison.
I mean, she made Wimbledon final, and I also remember she made Wimbledon final in 15 as well. So, yeah, 5 major finals. Yeah, when you actually think about it, like, it's you can almost also make the case that she wasn't an underachiever just because of all these stats. It's like, very few players can say they've done all this. So that's,
yeah, for sure. So yeah, like I said, tennis and bagels wishes Kavina Muguruza a great retirement. Let's just gonna keep enjoying. Like, I think the more and more we are seeing how consolidated the new generation of WTA players are right now, the retirement from Serena, obviously the rise of Iga Swiatek, Sabalenka, Rybakina, and Goff, and now, like, a few other players who are now on their way to retirement, and also, like, Rybakina Muguruza. So yeah, it's definitely interesting, and I guess, like, the pandemic kind of made of a lot of players kind of reconsider, like, what is their path in life. I guess, like, a lot of people, and tennis players included, kind of just got a lot of time with themselves to think about what they really want to do. So yeah, there's a interesting stuff happening in the 2020s already. So,
and actually, one other player that came to my mind just now, Raducanu, because you referenced her briefly in Stuttgart. I was very happy for her run to get to the quarters, because she played a really good match against Iga. That was very close. They fought, especially the first set. And she beat 2 really quality players to get there, and Noshkova the round before that, and she just crushed Kerber. Okay, Kerber is not the same player she used to be, but I still think this is a good run of form now for Anna. I think won a couple of Billie Jean King Cup matches also against Diane Perry and Caroline Garcia. So, like, this is quite good for her. I think she's played well in Madrid before as well. She played well in Indian Wells. I think if she can stay healthy, we can see her back in the top 50 this year. Fingers crossed, because she had basically nothing to defend for the entirety of last year. She had 3 surgeries last year, and I just hope people are less harsh on her, because I've always, I still have, like, huge respect for her, what she did at the US Open, you know, almost 3 years ago now, and she's still only, what, 21? Like, so I think she's definitely shown her quality this week, and I think she can keep it going, honestly. Like, Madrid, I think she can keep going there. Conditions are pretty fast. I was impressed how she was going forehand to forehand with Iga, and she's honestly just a very solid all-around player, you know? Like, just the fundamentals are definitely there. So now, and now she's back with her a more stable coaching relationship as well, which was a big talking point after the US Open, and mostly just been the coaching changes and the fitness. So if those two things are more stabilized, then she's going to be more or less where she belongs, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I think that I don't really see many holes in her game. If something can be exploited, it's by tactics and not necessarily a straightforward path to beating her. So I really like the way she plays, and I'm really happy that she's been able to keep herself healthy now. And obviously, you mentioned the coaching situation. I am really excited and hoping that things remain stable for her throughout the season, that we can see her playing like a full season of tennis without injuries, without setbacks, without major setbacks, really. Because sometimes there's like little things here and there that require them to pull out of a tournament or two. But like, yeah, it's hopefully she can just overall stay healthy until the end of the season. And yeah, I fully agree with you. I would say even with good draws and like good some deep runs, I could even like maybe see a top 30 finish, like if things really align for her. Yeah.
She definitely played at a top 30 level this week. And so, and it's possible for sure. She just has to stay healthy. I think that's the biggest.
For sure. Yeah.
Biggest thing.
Yeah. All right. So I guess that's all our time that we had for today. Thanks for showing up, Bunch. It's just always a pleasure. Let's try and see like if we, during the clay season, can get us three together and just like record a few more.
Yeah.
You can always follow Vansh at VanshV2K on Twitter. He's doing some awesome content for his own account and also for Tennis One, the app, which you can find the link for the download on Twitter and on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, the link is there. If you're just like on the podcast, I'm going to have some trouble like putting this link up, but if it's there, it means that I've succeeded in that. So, but I'll still put it in there. You can just copy paste it into your browser. But yeah, and you can follow me at Ronberg Andre, Tennis and Bagels at Tennis and Bagels, official, I believe. I never remember was there. I think it's just at Tennis and Bagels. And Owen is at Tennis Nation. Owen, probably hoping we can get him in the next episode as well. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us here today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. It was fun doing this, and hopefully we can get the gang back together with us, three of us, maybe after Madrid and before the French Open. So
yeah,
looking forward to seeing what happens.
Yeah, same here. All right, thanks so much, man. See y'all. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.